Young Millionaire.
Yes, sir.
All gone, bro.
Yo, we back.
Guys, this guy just had a huge blunder.
Look at him riding me out.
Let me not expose.
Typical African. We had some technical difficulties.
But no, episode 5, back in the mix.
Back at it again.
Today, we're fresh off of Eid.
Yes, it's Eid. You know, like I said, Eid Mubarak to all my Muslim brothers and sisters.
Yeah, I hope y'all had a blessed holy month. And I pray that the rest of this year brings you many blessings.
I mean.
But
also, before you go, it's also National Africa.
National is world.
Huh?
It's world Africa.
It's world? Day. It's not national?
I think it's world.
It's Africa Liberation Day.
Yeah. It's national.
No, it's not national.
It can't be national.
Okay, whatever. It's World Africa Day.
Nation is for one.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, it's okay. Well, I was trying to say nations, African nations, World African Day, but it is what it is. So, World African
Liberation Day.
It's a World African Liberation Day.
It's African Liberation Day.
Okay, I guess. You didn't even allow us to introduce.
Crazy. But no, hey, I'm your co-host, Ivan, and we got Young Money Millionaire here.
You know, Uncle E.
Ibrahim Abaji, back in the mix. And today,
we have immunity today.
Diplomatic immunity.
Yes, sir.
So when you come talk to us, please.
Look, guys.
Talk correctly.
Come correct, fam. We got immunity on that, you know?
We can get international police on you.
We have red passports today, bro.
I beg.
Y'all don't know about the red passports, huh?
Nah, but we have one of the most unique opportunities today, and we're blessed with a very special presence here.
Yes.
If you'd please do this.
No, I mean, like I said, we're very honored. You know, last week, you know, we got blessed. Mm-hmm. Papa Idro came through, mm-hmm. you know, blessed the wisdom. And, you know, it's funny enough, like I was saying before technical difficulties and, you know, arrived, mm-hmm. that last year, we had an Eid of last year. We recorded an episode. Mm-hmm. I was able to have Smiler come through. Yep. We recorded on Eid.
Dr. Ish.
So, you know, it's almost like customary that, you know, it's now another Eid 2020 that, you know, I'm lucky enough to have this time. My big sister, this is my, you know, literally, I grew up with her. Like, it's 5 siblings of us, but this is the sibling that I spent most of my life with growing up until she left and I celebrated while she went to college. But, you know, I'm so happy to have her here, and this is going to be it. I'm looking forward to this conversation. So, We will welcome Aissatou Dembo Baji.
Big high five.
Thank you guys so much for the very warm introduction.
Welcome.
Happy to be on this very insightful podcast.
Insightful.
And a lot of knowledge that's always shared on this platform. Uh-huh. Happy to be here. Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And allowing us the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But customary with every guest that we have on our episode, we like to start with the fundamentals. So who you are, your heritage, what you do, if you want to go into that, and just about you, a little bit about you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as you rightly said, my name is Aissatou Baji, born in the United States, in New York. My parents were Gambian diplomats. Well, my dad, a Gambian diplomat living here in the U.S. with my mom and my older siblings at the time. So I was born here then. Shortly after, parents moved back to Gambia. So I spent about 13 years of my life in Gambia. And from there, as a teenager, we moved to Sierra Leone, where my dad was posted
Freetown.
As a diplomat, Freetown, Sierra Leone. Very interesting time. We moved there right after the Sierra Leonean Civil War.
That was just me and Isaac.
Just me and Ibrahima, right? And my dad. Yeah, my mom stayed in Gambia, and we were there. It was right after the war, so you had a very large presence of the international community, particularly the UN. There was a UN peacekeeping mission there at the time. So it was kind of like living in a country going through transition from war to peace. So we lived there. I lived there for about 4 years, finished high school in Sierra Leone, and then moved to the United States, to Atlanta, Georgia, where I did my undergraduate at Spelman College.
Okay.
International
Shout
Studies.
Out.
So yeah, this Spelman. Graduated from Spelman, moved to New York again. In New York, I interned at the United Nations for about 8 months. Really good, interesting perspectives, but I had a lot of good advice to work for my government. I kept having this call from many people telling me, oh, you know, it's cool. You want to be in the international studies field, but perhaps it will be more meaningful if you did it for your government. So, you know, I was like, why not? You know, just try for a few years. Yep. Initially, I was like, I'm not sure. You know, Gambia is going through a very difficult time at the time with the government that we had and a lot of challenging perspectives that I was hearing, but why not give it a chance? So I moved to Gambia, joined the foreign ministry. I worked at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs for about 3 years. During the time, I did my master's in London at School of Oriental
Back in England.
And African Studies, University of London. I studied at SOAS. I did a specialized international relations course called Politics of Conflict, Rights and Justice.
Okay.
So really deep in that war to peace transitions again.
Mm.
And then went back to the foreign ministry, worked as a diplomat at the Foreign Service Office for about, a total of 3 years. Then I got posted to our permanent mission to the United Nations in New York. So here I came again, back in New York.
Full circle.
Full circle as a, you know, Gambian delegate at the United Nations. Initial year covering social affairs, women, children, and human rights, and also eventually focusing on peace and security, which is kind of my area. So doing a lot of peace and security work related to conflict, especially in Africa, peacekeeping missions, which is one of the biggest portfolios I have, just dealing with managing the Gambia's contribution to various peacekeeping missions. So both the military advisor and the police advisor. And yeah, also a lot of political analysis work there, given that those situations are very important to Gambia and we have a lot of interest in that area. Yeah, apart from that, I also cover disarmament issues, disarmament and other areas that have recently been heavily engulfed in its development. All throughout my career, I was never really interested in development, not even NGOs. I feel like Africa has like a proliferation of NGOs. Just everybody wants to have an NGO or whatever.
There are a lot
and
of
it's
NGOs.
All about development. They say, oh, I want to do a project, but you still look at the sustainability of those projects. I feel like those communities are still where they are. So I was just never really interested in that. I really believe that when you create an environment where peace can flourish and people have opportunities, naturally, the human mind will aspire to create development. But
that's,
that environment has to be there.
That's a very interesting insight. By the way, I hope you guys heard those accolades.
And also, before I have a quick, before we even dive in, Ivan, and have a round of questions and conversations, you know, here's a fun fact, guys. She mentioned she was born in New York, and my parents were diplomats at that time. When she was born, she is now in the exact same position my dad was when she was born.
Really?
At the UN in New York.
Wow.
So it's like literally full circle for her.
Yeah. That's pretty, wow.
Imagine that, you know, years later down the line, your daughter is in the same position as you were. When you were in New York.
Back in that
plane.
That's full very circle. Interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Cool fun fact.
No, guys, that's... Did you hear the accolades?
Okay. You did. See, this is why I say, you know? I'm just a small boy around.
We are just humble servants here. No, that's a very interesting perspective that you have, that you say you were never developed or never interested in development. Because I think when people, especially people in the diaspora, think of going back home or home, one of the first things that comes up is development, right? So what would you say for you was like the defining moment where you were like, wait a minute, it's not about development first, right? We need to think about making a more, I guess, an environment that would even allow it, right? Mm-hmm. Would you say that was a collection of events, or how did that thought process come about?
Yeah, so, you know, I think growing up as a child in a stable country like Gambia, when you saw development...
Stable at that time,
you saw UNDP, UNICEF. These are the agencies that you hear about.
Standard NGOs.
Mm-hmm. And then you hear about all these NGOs, you know, Catholic Relief Services and the rest. And
yeah.
They're all working towards development.
Right.
Because Gambia was stable. It had peace and security.
Okay.
So, like, I was like, oh, this is what international affairs or diplomacy in the country would look like. Or this is what development is. But then when we moved to Sierra Leone and you moved to a country that had gone through over 12 years of civil war. I remember Iboy and I, when we would go to school, on our way to school, even the street lights, you would see bullet holes in
that's
the street.
That's how
lights.
Fresh they were from war.
And then right along the roads to school, you would see people on wheelchairs or like holding, just
you saw the casualties of war. They were still present.
Whose arms were cut off. Uh-huh. You know, whose limbs were cut off during the war. So
how soon after the war were you there?
We lived there.
We went in 2004.
So that was like two years.
So yeah,
three years.
When
after
we
the
got
war.
There, it was heavy UN present.
Yeah,
I mean, you almost like I would say as a child, like we were afraid. Yeah. We were largely still afraid that you know.
There's no violence at the very present moment, but violence could erupt.
They were transitioning, right?
It was a transitioning society, and transitioning societies are very fragile. Because there's a lot of hurt,
yeah,
and there's a lot of human suffering, and people are so desperate for their lives to improve right away. So when I saw all those things, and then you also saw UN peacekeepers, like soldiers wearing blue helmets and carrying these big vehicles, and every
that's
little thing was almost about to trigger. I was like, whoa, like, who has time to implement a project?
Right.
When, like, human suffering is so sharp, like, violence is so sharp. You're not going to have time to even build a well if there's war.
Mm-hmm.
Or if there's conflict. So it exposed me to a different side, and I realized that it had to be the area of interest for me, because I saw that development was a perpetual thing in Africa.
Okay.
Like people were still poor and you were hearing all about the development projects. And then, you know, here you are where you can actually have a war to peace transition and then build a foundation for things to improve as a society. So I found that interesting. Not to discount development, I think it's very important. It's just not my area of expertise, and it's also not my area of preference, because I believe that the biggest impact where I can see is really giving people that opportunity to wake up in peace, to be able to go to the farm or to be able to go to their business. They have to be able to wake up in an environment that's safe, that's free from violence. Where, you know, a woman doesn't have to be afraid to leave the house because there's war, there's soldiers out there. She could face violence, sexual violence. No. Like, you know, for you to be able to even have creative ideas about what to do with your life, you need to be in a safe environment.
Right.
So, of course, so that's how the interest really spawned.
Interesting.
So, so development in your head was a byproduct of that safe environment for it to exist. Not necessarily your duty, but by even creating an environment where it can exist, you find that you're doing the greater part there, right?
Yeah. And I mean, there's also the other side of the argument is that war happens because there's no development.
Okay.
When people are poor and desperate, they pick up arms.
Would you say that's the most primary cause of most civil wars, at least in West Africa at that time?
I feel like that is exploited. You know, that is exploited. Like in Africa, in some countries, you have like the youthful population is like 65%, and half of them are unemployed.
Yeah.
So it's very easy for that unemployed percentage, especially if they're not educated, to be exploited into frustration in war. But what you see is those wars, the youths don't benefit from it.
Nope.
The society doesn't benefit. So they're exploited. Their suffrage is exploited.
And it's easy to change a young mind.
Absolutely.
A lot harder.
Much easier.
A lot easier than it would to change East mind.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. So the two go hand in hand. Mm. You know, if you don't have development, you will end up angry and maybe you will cause violence, but I don't think so, because you have a culture of peace in some societies where they don't turn into violent societies just because they're poor. So, you know, it's really about a culture of peace and sometimes the way people see the world. And also, you know, the influence around them, you know, really plays a big part. And in Africa, it's not only the African leaders, but sometimes you have the external influence. You have the issue of resources. You know, the scarcity of resources and how that can influence the war economy. So,
and given us being that we lived in Sierra Leone and their war is mainly famous for blood diamonds.
Right.
You know, they use diamonds, you know.
Right.
So I said, now looking back, what would you say, you know, because Sierra Leone, Liberia, I guess Ivory Coast, at that time in the 90s, there were a lot of West African countries that were going in civil war. So what would you say, looking back, well, genocide in Rwanda, that's a big notable one.
Yeah.
What were the big blunders made nationally and internationally, would you say, let's say from the UN perspective and, you know, by the leaders in their country perspective, what would you say were the major blunders?
So,
or what can we learn from? How do we prevent that, you know, history from never happening again?
What we can learn from it is really, first of all, as Africans, taking ownership of our part. Of our part of conflicts. I feel like we really easily turn to the outside influence and say this is a source of conflict, but we don't take accountability for our part. That's one. So definitely really meaning the issue of African unity, really respecting the diversity within Africa, and really growing from strength to strength and believing in our human potential, and most importantly, having good leadership. This is something that we should learn as Africa. And I feel like most of these conflicts, if you look back at it, the leadership really failed. Now, when it comes to the UN, I do not see in particular the UN as the fault to blame, but who is the United Nations? And this is a question that I always ask people when we talk about...
Fella said it.
Yeah, because the United
Nations... I've always thought it's the five...
No.
Who is the United Nations, I said, actually?
So
I feel like we should, because some people, we hear about it. Like, yeah. Do you really know what is the United Nations?
Facts. So right. People always say, what is the United Nations doing? Who is the United Nations? Or where is the United Nations? Or why didn't the United Nations end this and that? But we are the United Nations. The United Nations is the countries of the world.
Right.
193 countries make up the General Assembly of the United Nations.
General Assembly.
And the job of the United Nations is to respond to global issues. But these global issues is up to us, each of our countries that are members, to come together, to work together and say, okay, we're going to have this as an issue that we're going to solve. This is a global issue. Whether it's climate change, whether it's poverty, whether it's education, whether it's war or conflicts around the world, whether it's all these issues that are just global. It's really about each of our countries working together to do that. And even in the Security Council, which you say the P5.
That's I mean...
Guess what? That's the biggest myth. Because the P5, yes, of course, they're the power
breakers. What's the P5?
The P5 are the five permanent members of the Security Council.
Yeah.
If you know, the UN has six organs. Mm-hmm. The General Assembly is where all of us belong.
Yeah.
Uganda, Gambia, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, yeah. All the countries, 193 countries. General
That's
Assembly.
Where all the famous speeches are made.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
September,
with the green background.
Every September. Yeah. Yeah. But the Security Council has a specific mandate.
Yeah.
The General Assembly deals with all issues, but the Security Council deals with peace and security. They have a responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security. So if you have a particular issue that is not going to cause an international peace and security, don't expect the Security Council to take it up.
Were there any African countries on that council in the 90s?
Still today.
Well, I know about today.
What are the five?
So the Security Council is actually 15 members, not five. So that's another myth. People think the Security Council is the P5. The P5 is, of course, the United Kingdom, the United States, Russia, China, and France.
What is France doing there?
Boy, what makes them what makes them unique is that they have the veto power. So when they say no, a resolution or a document cannot go through. But they cannot make anything work on their own. Because the remaining 10 members, which are non-permanent, they're every 2 years that they come on board.
Okay.
And they're geographically distributed.
Uh-huh.
So you have three there from Africa every 2 years.
What are the current three?
So how it works, first of all, is that if you have a resolution, the P5 have to say yes. But in addition to the P5 saying yes, you also have to get 9 out of the 15 votes. Yes.
But all 5 of them have to be in agreement.
If they're not in agreement, they can also just abstain.
So for someone who's wondering what a resolution is, can you explain it to them?
So a resolution, whether it's a General Assembly resolution, an ECOSOC resolution, or a Security Council resolution, it's like a document that is like a symbol of the ideas and the agreed language and consensus built among the members of that particular group. Mm-hmm. So when you agree that, okay... there's a problem in our societies with maybe discrimination against persons with albinism. How do you solve this issue? You have a resolution. You draft the resolution, the main sponsor of it. You have countries bringing their perspectives of how they think you can improve on that issue. You negotiate among countries whether this language is something that can work. You give the UN specific task on how to address that issue, whether it's going to be through UNDP that they're going to support that issue or whatever. Whichever UN institution, you give the UN the mandate and the job to say, do this. The Secretariat is only there to do what member states want.
And is there a required amount of diplomats that have to represent a country?
No, it depends on every country. Every country has a right to choose the number of diplomats you have. Mm-hmm. A lot of countries, especially from Africa, have smaller delegations because that's what they can afford. Diplomacy is expensive, especially to maintain staff in a Western country.
Yeah.
But it depends on each delegation. But I don't really think it matters how many. It's the effectiveness of the diplomats.
Because so you can have 10 useless ones and 3 really good ones, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, it really is just what it is. But yeah, so the resolutions, they have to be passed. And if they pass by consensus, meaning everybody is on board, then it gives it more weight because it shows that this is something that we all agree is an issue. Mm-hmm. And then you have resolutions that are voted. Any delegation, any country has the right to vote against a resolution if that resolution contains things that are against your national interests or your national laws. It's up to every to get a delegation.
Mm.
Sometimes you can even vote against a particular paragraph because maybe you agree to it everything, but that one particular paragraph contains controversial issues to you.
Mm.
So these resolutions, they give the UN the job to do.
Okay.
Member states have agreed and UN. The UN Secretariat is just there to respond to member states. They cannot tell us what to do. Mm-hmm. And that's what sometimes makes the UN...
Sounds like UN is just, we're here to help you sort out a lot of your problems and create a formalized process of things.
It's like really the platform where all the governments in the world come together to solve like a particular problem.
Mm.
It has created the misconception you've said, though. Now people, you know, I'm even part of it. I'm like, why didn't the UN do anything about it?
Yeah. And I think it's also, without having a deeper analysis into it, you can't know better. Because when you see, if I'm in, you know, Uganda and I see a bunch of blue helmets coming through, I'm thinking the UN is its own organization. I'm not thinking past that, right?
Yeah.
Especially at a young age.
Right.
I think it's when you get older that you do have the opportunity to learn things like this.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I think we ask a lot of questions because the expectations are so high.
Mm.
And we think of the UN as this independent thing that can just come to our countries and do what they want.
Mm.
But we forget that we are the UN and we've set the rules for the UN.
Mm.
So the UN, you set the rules to say, okay, you're a sovereign country, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
You get to allow the UN to do what they should do in the country. The UN cannot force countries to come together in the Security Council and solve the crisis in Syria. If countries don't want to work together, the UN is like ineffective. And that is its biggest flaw. Uh-huh. But at the same time, if you want to empower the UN to do things, then a lot of countries are like, oh, you know, it's like an organization being used by Western powers to do whatever they want. It's like neo-colonialist. So it's like either way or either or, they can never get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But people overlook a lot of important issues about the UN.
Mm-hmm.
For example, even when the Security Council doesn't get along to solve issues, okay, you still have 14 or 15 peacekeeping operations around the world where people are in homeless shelter, in UN refugee centers right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only protection they have in those conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. Mm-hmm. You think about the fact that UN provides food assistance to 80 million people around the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's without the UN, they would not. You talk about vaccines, like 45% of the world's children rely on UN to provide vaccines.
How many percent?
45%.
Wow.
45%. It's not even like a joke. Yeah. You have over 100,000 peacekeepers who are keeping peace in countries of conflict around the world where you have a peacekeeping mission. Without the blue helmet, literally, their lives would be in havoc or in wreck. Yeah. Nobody sees these little things that the UN does.
Yeah.
So, you know.
So, guys, we need, yeah, this is, UN is integral.
It's, you said it's integral?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it also sounds like a complex.
It's very complex. It's beyond what we can comprehend in this episode.
Which is why we have a diplomat here today.
Yeah,
help us understand better.
Yeah, for sure.
No, but going back to the question I had asked earlier, when did that rule come into effect that three African members had to be on the Security Council at a time?
So, okay, so the way that the Security Council has been set up has been 15 members.
From the beginning of the UN, right?
From the initial formulation of the Security Council and the memberships that were established therein, that was how it's
always been.
Not
like
the
that.
League of Nations, the United Nations.
Okay.
Yeah, because you know the United Nations came off from the League of Nations.
Yeah.
In addition to that, those countries have the independence to vote in favor or against any issues. Also, every month, a new member of the 15 countries is the president of the Security Council. So they get to set the entire agenda of the Security Council. So that gives them leverage to bring to platform issues of international peace and security that may not necessarily be of interest, but they are very relevant to our continent, for example. So that gives them that leverage. Of course, the A3, as we like to call them, they are supposed to reflect the interests of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, national interest sometimes comes in the way.
Appreciate that, yeah.
And sometimes also relationships between some members of the A3 and other members, especially the P5, can have a lot of influence, depending on who their friends are. So it really comes down to international politics again.
I see.
But the nature of the Security Council has changed a lot, by the way, guys, because you've now seen a different sort of influence from China and also Russia on one side.
Yeah.
And then you have the other other three members of the P5, which is US, UK and France.
Yeah.
So now you have China and Russia kind of like balancing out the world order, as you would say.
Mm.
And it's really about checks and balances, as far as I see it,
alliances.
On many different issues. You know, not letting certain priorities take over others, or identifying that these countries have specific interests there and not, and kind of like having a check and balance around those issues.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And you know, talking about now your line of work in the peacekeeping mission, can you at least give us an update or understanding? You know, you went last December on various peacekeeping tours, Sudan, Mali, you know, war zones that UN, heavy UN peacekeeping, African soldiers present, even Gambia soldiers. So for those who don't know what's going on in these regions or these countries, can you just give us a brief, you know,
and what it looks like?
What it looks like, if you don't know what's going on.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So maybe perhaps just to give a little bit of context, the United Nations doesn't have its own army. So when the Security Council says, okay, there's a problem in Mali, the Malian government has come before the Security Council and said, you know what, we cannot handle this crisis situation anymore within our borders. We need international support. That means the presence of foreign forces. The United Nations Security Council would look at the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And if they agree to open a peacekeeping mission, the UN doesn't have an army, but it has 193 member states. So the 193 member states are invited to nominate military or police to serve in the United Nations peacekeeping.
Mm.
That's how the UN creates its entire army that is deployed to those countries. So you bring your own military individuals. They also bring the equipment. And they're wearing their uniform from home, but they're wearing a UN blue helmet.
Okay.
Is there a governance over that, though?
There's an administrative overbody that facilitates the whole process.
Is it kind of like a NATO?
No, because this is the United Nations.
No, I'm saying like, but in terms of, since it's countries, different countries, you know, have bringing in their military
processes,
equipment and manpower,
so
infantrymen.
It's all like, there's
but
a whole
who governs it? Is it under the UN?
Under the UN. There's a whole department within the Secretariat. So that's what I, when, so the defense section of military approves and establishes a resolution that establishes a peacekeeping mission, mm-hmm. the Secretary of the United Nations has a whole department called the Department of Peace Operations.
Okay.
They peace. Are they have an entire office for Office of Military Affairs.
Okay.
And you also have like the police
division. And these are active duty servicemen for active their individual countries.
So don't forget the UN staff are also from UN member states.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. even like right now, the head of the OMA, Office of Military Advisor, he's Lieutenant General Loiti. He was the head of his military in his country, in Uruguay. Okay, so they're nominated there. And so now they have a whole structure. It's like a rigorous process. You go through first identifying that you want to nominate. This is what you want to deploy. So there are so many categories of things you can do in a peacekeeping mission. And you choose, okay, I want to be a force protection company. One of the mandates of that is you're going to be guarding the headquarters of the field mission. You're going to be providing security to VIP. Okay, then what happens next? They have to come to your country and inspect your equipment.
See so that, that's what happened with, like, let's say Mali force. And stuff then.
Then okay. now when they see that your force is there, okay, you've done this training. The United Nations does the standard training across all peacekeeping missions, all peacekeepers from the world.
Makes
this
sense.
Is the training you're going to do. Mm-hmm. Okay, all of you, you're going to wear your national military uniform, but you're going to wear a blue helmet. You're going to have a blue UN tag on your arm. Your military equipment vehicles, they're all going to be painted white with UN written on it.
Mm-hmm.
So they standardize the whole military
system standardized
across
military.
All the countries that are deploying.
Makes sense.
Then now, they get to the field mission. Everybody has your role, but it's all structured under like a force commander. So what you end up having is like, it looks like one army,
yeah.
but it's really different people doing different roles.
Gotcha.
And they're all standardized. Even in the field, they have like a force commander who is in charge of the entire military personnel and military contingents, but he could be different from a different country than all the people who are serving under him. So that's kind of how it is. So Gambia, we've been in peacekeeping for about 30 years now. We've had like police and also
military police,
both military officers and police officers. They have different roles in peacekeeping. Where the conflict is worst, you have the military. And then in areas with community policing where there's crime and things like that, you have the police. So Gambia has had that. We have about over 240 peacekeepers. Which it sounds small, but Gambia is considered one of the biggest contributing countries because of our population.
Mm-hmm.
We're only 2 million people and we're producing that much in UN peacekeeping. You have countries that are like billions of people and they have like 4,000 or 5,000 people. So if you compare to our population,
percentage like of population biggest. Or percentage yeah. of military population.
So yeah, and
Is there a language that's agreed upon in the military?
No. So the deployments have to be they're either English speaking or French speaking.
Okay.
But it doesn't really matter for the military because they're under command. If you understand the structures of the military, when they're under command, they're under the direct leadership of whoever is heading the contingent.
Okay.
But usually they're English speaking. In French missions, you have, if they're police, you have to not deploy people who speak French because the police actually interact with the local population, like talk to them, do community policing and the likes. And the military is different because their job is more rigorous and strictly operational. So that's kind of how it works. So Gambia has been in peacekeeping for over 30 years. We have that many peacekeepers. We have them in various places. We have in Darfur, UNAMID, which I visited 2 years ago. We have peacekeepers in Mali. We have in DRC, that's Congo. We have in South Sudan, which I visited last June. Yeah, we have them in a couple of places. We even have them in Israel. You'll be surprised.
Oh, okay.
So we have them in different places, yeah.
But what about...
What does a peacekeeping mission look like?
That's a big question.
We don't have time for this question.
That's a big question. But the first thing you're going to see is people who are wearing military uniform or police uniform with a blue helmet. That's the color of peace and the color of the UN flag. You're going to see them in heavy protective gear. You're going to see them doing patrols in neighborhoods, like securing the neighborhood where people are allowed to move freely without violence. Peacekeeping in particular is not there to like fight the war. It's to separate peace between the
maintain order.
So you cannot have a peacekeeping mission without a peace agreement.
Okay.
When the parties to the conflict agreed that we're going to work on this agreement to stop fighting, then you can have a peacekeeping mission to make sure that they're not fighting. To just be there to make sure that they're not engaging in violence. And the sad thing about that is people will say, oh, sometimes peacekeeping is not effective because of the rules of peacekeeping. You're there to keep peace. You're not there to fight. Because if you are the rebel and Ibrahima is the government and I'm taking sides with Ibrahima, that makes you want to target
Stryker.
Me. That makes you want to target me, and you're not going to see me as being neutral anymore.
Yeah.
So their job is to be strictly neutral and to separate the parties. But of course, that's hard because people want you to take sides.
Yeah.
But that's not their mandate.
A high level overview, that's what it entails, right? You're there to just.
They're there to maintain play order, neutrals. Yeah. So almost, what do they call it? Like the escalate? What do they?
De-escalate.
De-escalate the tension. Avoid, separate the parties from engaging in violence so that the peace agreement that is signed can really go into effect. But of course, that is the specific mandate. But of course, there are some peacekeeping missions where they're mandated to even use force.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the number one rule of peacekeeping is they cannot attack unless they attack.
Mm-hmm.
But in some conflict situations where the enemy is the enemy, like mm-hmm. you cannot be neutral when you're in situations that are very dangerous. Like they are authorized to use force to neutralize the people who don't, the side of the groups that don't want to cooperate with mm-hmm. keep the peace, you know. Sometimes they have that mandate. But it's very controversial as well because countries are sovereign.
Yeah.
And they don't want the UN to be there, like, you know, using their military to fight war in their countries. So it's very sensitive. It's very legal as well. And it's, you know.
It sounds, I mean, it's beyond me. It sounds very complex. Right?
It's very complex.
Yeah. But are there penalties for member states that violate any, like, peacekeeping missions?
So what do you mean, violate in what way?
Say, if me and you are at war, I'm the enemy, you're the sovereign state, right? And you come in to, like, we sign a treaty and you come in to keep peace. Is there a penalty if
he breaks that treaty
and, say, harm some of your troops?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because
sometimes and UN soldiers are quite casualties, right?
Yeah. A lot. I'll give you an example, Mali. Mali, I've never seen a peacekeeping mission like Mali because, like I said, your job of peacekeepers is to be neutral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But in Mali, like, the crisis situation has evolved now where you have terrorism in mm-hmm. Mali. And
what type? Which terrorist groups?
You have Al-Shabaab and all the bad ones there.
Boko Haram, are they still there?
They're, like, all the terrible elements, international terrorist groups are in Mali.
Okay.
So now the UN Security Council and peace does not recognize terrorism as one of the things that peacekeeping has to fight.
Right.
So you are in a mission where there's terrorism, but your mandate does not allow you to fight terrorism.
Uh-huh.
So what do the terrorists know? That if they keep killing UN peacekeepers, they will frustrate the UN. Uh-huh. They will make the UN pack up.
Puts a lot of
pressure. Think that they're going to make the UN pack up and leave. Countries will withdraw.
Yeah.
And then they can now have more leverage to do violence.
Okay.
But we're not leaving. We're there.
Yeah.
So what do you do in those type of situations? And that comes back to your question. That's where the Security Council Sanctions Committee come into play and other elements. There's so many powerful things that the Security Council can do to hammer down on those countries. First of all, there's 100% accountability when you kill peacekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not going to go scot-free for that.
Yeah.
Secondly, okay, when you're on the sanctions committee, first of all, when they hit you with the international sanctions, you cannot even travel outside of the territory. You are like a wanted person. Mm-hmm. Your whole life, it's like your money in the bank, if it's abroad, frozen. Mm-hmm. You cannot even leave that region or that territory. So they have
If they attack the UN... this attack, they will retaliate with military force as well.
Absolutely. So that's the stabilization missions. That's different from the regular peacekeeping missions. You have missions where, like I said, the situation is so bad, you cannot be neutral.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, they have the mandate to attack before they are attacked in those places. And Mali is one of those places. You're not going to wait for the terrorists to come and kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happened many times. But if you see that happening, of course, you have the mandate. You don't need instruction. You fire and you neutralize the enemy.
And in context, like, how important is Mali? Of course, this is in the region of West Africa, right?
Yeah.
For how imperative it is to stabilize Mali, because if they're unstable and are outrun by terrorist organizations, that's the whole West African region now becomes destabilized.
It's interesting you ask that question because a lot of us believe that the conflict in Mali escalated from Libya.
You see,
after the fall of Gaddafi, you had like a proliferation of Libya small arms and weapons.
Yeah.
And you had so many little terrorist groups and armed groups, blah, blah, blah. And then the minute that they're being forced out of Libya, Mali, if you look at it geographically, is a big land.
It's huge.
Very big.
And it goes deep into the Sahara.
Most of the north is unoccupied territory.
Because it's Sahara.
And for many years, like, the government was not very present there because they don't even have a population to guard a lot of population there. You have only about less than 15% of the population in the north.
Yeah.
So when these terrorists were moving, what better safe space than a big territory in the north?
Ungoverned.
And then ungoverned basically, So then they occupied this territory and then they used it as a launch pad. They wanted a separate what better way to create a new state, right? Mm. You have the territory, and then, of course, if you know much about Mali, has a lot of resources.
Yeah.
That also brings a lot of the international context. You have international powers who are heavily invested in Mali because Mali has so many resources. This goes back all the way to colonialism. Why was Mali colonized in the first place? The resources in that region.
Why was any country, countries?
It's not like Mansa Musa was from present-day Mali.
Mali
the
used to have the resources.
I mean, are crazy.
So now what? Yeah. So now you have that context. Uh-huh. So now the crisis is not only you have international stakeholders who have a lot of interest in Mali's economic resources. This dates back to colonialism. And now you have terrorist groups in the north who are like, oh, we're going to occupy this territory. We're going to have a new state here. And then they're overwhelming the military government, the military itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like the military cannot respond to the threat coming.
They don't have the resources.
So you have UN peacekeeping that comes. But even the UN peacekeeping is not enough because the mandate of the UN peacekeeping does not allow them to fight terrorism. It just says that they have to support the implementation of the peace agreement. So now what's happening in Mali, you have so many other international bodies that are coming into play to respond to the crisis, you know. You also have a regional force called the G5, neighboring countries coming together to say they're going to try to. So it's very, very complicated.
But Mali has to be stable, though. Like I said, too, in context to the region.
It's very sad because the conflict there now has sprung into Burkina Faso and Niger. If you look at the news,
I knew about Niger, but I didn't know about Burkina Faso.
See, I didn't even know about Burkina.
Terrorism spread, and they're retaliating because their soldiers of those countries are serving in Mali in the peacekeeping mission.
See?
So you see, because those countries have sent peacekeepers to serve in Mali, they're retaliating now and going after their countries and their neighboring countries. So the country, the terrorism has now spread into parts of Niger and northern Burkina. And it's terrifying because this can spread across the whole West Africa.
Mm-hmm. And it's currently going.
Yeah, because in West Africa, you have the same passport. You can just use your ID card, your ECOWAS ID card to travel to any West African country. And you know, we all look alike. Mm-hmm. So anybody can be a terrorist moving into a different country and just really causing a lot of havoc.
Mm-hmm.
So we all have a big stake to play in that. And that's why Gambia is also in Mali, because you fight the enemy from away before they come to your shores.
Yeah.
But it's really challenging. And these things have really a lot of different dimensions. Yeah.
Interesting. That point that you bring up, that most West Africans look the same, because in, say, Uganda, when we had the issue with Al-Shabaab, it's,
how do you identify?
I mean, you can identify based on physical appearance. You can kind of like identify Somali over a Ugandan.
Oh yeah.
And I think that's one of the advantages that our government had. But I didn't think
West
about
Africa.
That.
Yeah, you know, you see Gambian Senegalese. You know, it's very hard to know the difference.
Brothers.
Guinean and stuff.
Yeah, it's a scary time. Anyway, I was in Mali in December, and I went with a couple of UN member states, about 20 of us from different parts, some from Africa, some from Europe, America. And, you know, when we got to Mali, I was, you know, just like all of them, we're wearing business casual clothes. We arrived in Bamako. The next day, we were going to Timbuktu, which was really being targeted by terrorists. So the next day, when it was time for us to go there, I came down the hotel and I was wearing like a black abaya, like I was from the Middle East, like top to bottom black. And my colleagues were like, yo, what's going on? Why are you dressed like? I'm like, because. The minute they know we're from the UN and we're international
civil
servants, we are a threat. We had high security, by the way, but I wasn't taking chances. So I dressed like a local.
She ain't taking no chances.
No, I dressed like a local. I already look like the local. So why not just keep myself safe? Just in case, you know,
you never know.
Change personalities and neutralize yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They do that. They do that. Even like you see CIA when they travel across, you'll see they'll blend in, right? With the
native. You gotta disguise yourself.
Disguise yourselves and try and blend in as much as you can.
Yeah.
You know, just for safety reasons.
For sure.
So, you know, it's just not in the movies.
Yeah, no, this is real.
This is real life, you know?
I think that's where the movies get it from, is real life.
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot to handle personally.
I don't know how she do it, fam. I ain't going.
Yeah, it's overwhelming. Sometimes you go to some conflict situations, guys. Like you're like, like, we love Africa so much, but if you go to some parts of Africa and you see what's happening, like, you just go into a dark pit. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when I went to South Sudan, I've been to other conflict situations in Africa. I grew up in Sierra Leone, but I never saw anything like that in my life. Mm-hmm. I've never seen human suffering like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you see people, you see these guys, you know, they're not even 18 years old and they're holding guns mm-hmm. in the streets. Mm-hmm. Like, they're wearing military uniform because they're supposedly part of the military or police.
Mm-hmm.
But then I didn't even go far outside of the capital to see that that's like the life for a lot of young mm-hmm. men and
yeah.
women.
Yeah.
And one of the things that struck me was I wasn't seeing young women in the streets. I'm like, where are the young women at?
Mm-hmm.
And like, apparently, like, that's because the violence is so sharp, then there's so much sexual violence, they're going to get raped, that you find a lot of people who are just staying indoors or have fled.
Mm.
So you only see older women, or all the young people you see, they're unemployed, sitting around, or, you know, and it's a new country, so it's going to take time, but like, it takes you to a dark pit when you see the young people who don't have any ambition, any other alternative to have ambition. You just wake up and you survive.
They're just trying to survive. That's their everyday plan.
You survive to the next day. You don't even have time to say, okay, I'm going to watch CNN to know what's happening in the world. Because yeah. that is your world, you know? Yeah. You're just surviving to the next day. And it's sharp. When you come back from those situations, you like go into like a moment of humility. You don't want to see anything.
You have to.
You just really know we have a lot of work to do on the continent.
Which is so sad, because South Sudan is another abundant place.
Absolutely.
That's very sad to hear that things like that happen.
Yeah, and I think they struggle a lot with identifying a lot of South Sudanese that I saw from the conflict. They struggle with the identity of nationalism.
Mm.
Don't forget, South Sudan is a new country.
Very new,
so
yeah.
a lot of people see themselves
as the newest country
group.
In Africa.
Yeah.
yeah. The ethnic group is what they really identify with. Either so when you Dinka, say you're South Sudanese, like, yeah, that's a growing perspective, but it takes time to build that identity. Look at our countries. Like, some of us have been independent for more than 50 years, and we're still struggling to get people
to this day
to just get rid of tribalism and just see the country.
Tribalism
first.
Is still
less
very
of a country
prevalent.
That is
yeah.
like so
yeah.
new. So
I think with the case of South Sudan, nationalism is more. They have more nationalism outside of South Sudan,
yeah.
because I have South Sudanese
inside,
friends.
Than inside, than
they're
yes.
extremely
country.
Intelligent.
Very.
Like, their human capital is extremely intelligent.
Very.
Like, even their diplomats, like, you know, you see, like, they're so intelligent. They're so, you know, educated mm-hmm. because they've lived abroad for most of their
but
life.
But I've been saying that it seems like the diaspora.
I feel like they have more nationalistic view to South Sudan than the people there.
Mm.
Outside then.
Yeah, the diaspora more than the
because
people.
They're in the diaspora.
Yeah, because
it's like
they're in the
when
diaspora.
You're Ugandan, when you go to the diaspora, you're Ugandan.
Yeah.
But when you come into Uganda, you're like your whatever
Madi
you are.
And,
exactly.
Yeah.
True.
And a lot of them, especially the ones that I'm friends with, have grown up their whole lives here. So the idea of home is that much sweeter.
Hmm.
But without being in that situation, you can't really realize that, you know. So
yeah, at the same time, there's a lot of potential, you know. Again, it takes time for countries to really get to the stage where there's peace, there's stability, for you to be able to build strong institutions and flourish well in society. It's going to take time. But it's sad to see those type of situations in the continent, because you know that they're being left out from a whole generation of development. You look at the world today, like, everything is on technology. The world is moving so fast. You have growing economies. And these societies, some of them are not going to be able to benefit from that just yet.
Yeah.
Or anytime soon, because they're thrown by conflict. So it's a sad reality, but there's hope. And, you know, we can only keep praying and working hard on that.
I feel like we could ask a million questions about this.
Look, but, for reals, man.
But let's say, okay, what is your favorite thing about being posted to the UN right now?
I have to say it's dealing with peacekeeping.
Yeah.
Just because it's a circle.
Yeah.
Like, when we grew up in Sierra Leone, I always knew that I wanted to work in post-conflict or conflict-related societies, because I just saw how much it affected the society and how it traumatized me as a child. You know, you wake up, you're going to school. Like, you're supposed to be ready for your school lesson. But then when there's a traffic stop, you're surrounded by people whose arms and their limbs were cut off because of war. Mm-hmm. Like, that reality as a child, like,
yep.
I always knew I wanted to work in this field. So when I'm in New York now and I have the opportunity to influence, like, policies related to how peacekeeping can be more effective to respond to the conflict situations, I have both a childhood memory of it and also, like, an adult, like, professional expertise and really just seeing beyond the high-rise buildings of New York, yeah, or even our capitals,
yeah,
or our countries where the things are normal. That being able to see those countries that have, you know, lost everything and are at the very bottom, and being able to work on how to improve those societies, it brings a lot of perspective to my life. So that's definitely
gives her highlight. Purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think that's one thing that a lot of people are searching for.
Searching too. For purpose, you know, and it's tied down, like you said, you know. Now she's saying it, I think about it, I'm like, yeah, this makes sense, you know, being from that childhood, you know, environment we were in, you know, little things like that can go all the way, right, when you have certain experiences that you remember for a while, and they were so, you know, impactful.
And, and it changes the rest of your life.
Yeah, yeah. So, that's definitely, definitely. But, you know, we got some bands, though.
Yeah.
For her, you know. So Ivan, which bands we going to give her first?
I want to ask this, a fun question.
She made a controversial statement when she came here. And sorry, I have to poke Ivan at this too. Because you guys know who Ivan's favorite Afrobeats artist is. It's Oluwabona.
Oluwabona.
So, I sort of came here. She came here. She had a statement about Burna.
What was that statement?
Well, I'll let her say it. I don't want to misquote her. Anyway,
I want to hear it straight from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, let's hear it from you. So given that we know we've seen the rise of Burna Boy, you know, he's doing good. 2019 was his year, per se. But what do you think of it, Isoda? What do you think
I
of
him? I think he's a fantastic artist. I just think he has a problem with being humble. And not all humility is a bad thing, but I think that it's hard to appreciate him because he just makes so much noise about it right now. And I feel like he's a great artist. He stayed in his lane. His consistency had landed him to where he is right now. But the way he's been behaving these days,
he's moving on social mad.
Media and making it seem like, you know, like this is like all about him and his territory, I think it disrespects
people. You think it's gotten to him?
The game before him.
Do I think it's gotten to him?
Yeah.
That's what she said.
It sounds like it, you know.
Well, shoot. First of all, I don't disagree. I'm a fan of his music, right? Because it's very authentic.
I think that's key to say, though.
I'm a fan of his music. As a person, I can't speak to that because I don't know him. But I don't think it surprises me to see how he's reacting to this most recent run of fame.
Success.
Because I think I always saw him as that type of person.
Interesting.
Because he's very bold and outlandish. Yeah, you know, it all came to the Coachella thing where he said, you know, respect me, I'm an African giant.
But he was bigger before even the Coachella.
He was.
I remember Burna Boy from back then.
Way back.
He's really been in the game for a while. And I think what makes him successful right now is that he stayed in his lane and he's consistent.
And he became authentic.
But I think he makes it seem like he just came above Wizkid, Davido, and the rest. I'm like, no, because the fact of the matter is...
No, Wizkid and Davido are definitely...
2019, Wizkid and Davido were really taking it, slowing down. And Burna Boy came with Africa Giant and ran with it with the market.
I don't know.
But that does not mean that he is much better than...
I don't think Burna Boy is better than... Wizkid or Davido for
say. Okay, wait.
No, I mean.
He really believes he is.
Huh?
But I don't think that's the question here. I think the question is
Burna Boy getting ahead of himself? Or is he staying, you know?
He's beefing with Davido right now over
he's
this.
He's beefing with Davido over what?
Mm-hmm. Over this. He's
because, you know,
this,
we have to talk about
king.
It because we don't want this when we have our artists have success, you know, they start feeling this way. In terms of, you know,
guys, I don't.
But he's Nigerian, though. This is how Nigerians are.
No,
you know,
no.
But I personally, I'm not shocked that side of his personality is coming through because, I mean, if you look at his history, like he was kicked out of the UK, he couldn't come.
He
back
got
for
deported,
6 years.
Right? Was he
did something when he was 19,
yeah,
and we don't know
that
what.
That does not excuse having bad behavior.
But they all have bad behavior. I sort of know.
Yeah,
this
I know.
Artist.
But I mean,
Davido
is changing his act.
But if we're doing it rankings, Burna Boy's significance, right?
But
Burna Boy has taken Afrobeats to new heights.
He has. And I'm not saying that his behavior is excusable. I'm just saying I'm not surprised. That's all I'm saying.
And that's deep.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great artist, but it's just like now, every time you listen to him, you don't even want to listen to him because you're like, you don't know how to calm down, you know? And his music is talented. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that his personality would have really helped people to appreciate it more. Sometimes people appreciate it more when you like, ask for appreciation.
Yeah.
You know?
He did, like, if you go on YouTube, you watch, like, his NPR. There's some performances where it's as if, like, he's very nonchalant the way he was performing.
The NPR Tiny Desk one.
The NPR Tiny Desk. He was a little bit disappointing, you know. He didn't really seize that opportunity, you know.
Even when Trevor interviewed him.
Yeah.
When Trevor interviewed him, I'm sorry, but his answers were weak. Like, you should have been more prepared for a big stage like that.
Do you think...
He ain't going to get it, though, a lot of times, though, this stage.
Do you think celebrities are obligated to kind of, like you were saying, provide in-depth or stronger answers?
No, but I think when you're humble, people see that as cute. Oh, it's like he's shy. Mm. Like when Malik Berry does that type of interview, you're like, oh, he's shy. Mm. But Bonobo with the big mouth on Twitter, when he does that, you're like, you with all your big mouth on Twitter, you cannot even give a proper interview and say something like... It's like a Beyonce.
His Breakfast Club, too. He wasn't that that elaborate. But, I mean, we can't...
Breakfast Club is problematic in itself. So.
Yeah, okay. Let me not use Breakfast Club as a start. But, you know, it's like... Online versus maybe to Isidro, some people are much braver online. You know, they can be, you know, Twitter warriors.
That's facts.
You know, but they sit next to Trevor,
the internet. Huh? The fault
once you
of
sit
the
next
internet.
To Trevor, you're like, man, where's this boy now? But it's almost as if it's two different personalities.
I just feel like, you know, a little bit of humility makes people appreciate you a lot more. Your work should speak for yourself, and that's one of the things Bernard needs to understand. Now he's an international artist. He's already big, and people already like him. Don't ruin that. That liking that people have of you with your big mouth, saying arrogant things or doing arrogant things. You really have to measure yourself to allow the amplification of your music to speak for you, you know, instead of just these random rants that don't make sense. But
I
think his thing is great.
I agree, but I've like his music for me is just
that's evidence number one. So
like
Burna Wizkid or Davido.
When?
Top threes, guys.
Top three
right now.
When?
Let's not even say right now. Based on their body of work up to now, right? Who is like top three?
Man, that's such a complex question.
No,
because listen,
it could be your opinion.
Wizkid had the biggest record out of all of them. Ojulegba made it like across the continent, right? And then it made it to London. Drake hopped on it. Skepta hopped on it. That put like Wizkid on another level, right? As far as albums go, none of them can compare to African Giant.
No.
You know?
As far as I'm concerned, there will never be an album like Superstar.
Well, I said, but Superstar was not
Superstar
global, though.
That's what I'm talking about. We need to look outside of the numbers. For me, it's really about the authenticity of the star. Like, there's some albums
I think
that you will never forget
in attaching,
your life.
Yeah, attaching your nostalgia.
Because
or you know,
how can you put a song
and right
like,
now,
tease me against something like, I don't know,
Dangote. Yeah.
But that was 10 years ago, and this is where it is. Because of Tease Me, now Dangote is appreciated. Let's
is
be honest.
True?
Like that's
no,
how
I said.
Wizkid really, really made he contributed a lot to making Afrobeats how mainstream.
Of course, but we're talking about albums.
That, people like Burna Boy. Burna Boy was in the game since then. Nobody was listening to his music like now.
But
so those people created, open up the doors, created the platform, and Wizkid is not the start. You go all the way back to Two Face, P Square, like Nice.
Yeah. Those are the
stars. More hits records. You know, like
Wizkid
also
doesn't become who he is without like Fuse ODG.
That you can say that too. But if you talk about appreciation of body of work, you know, like I think that Burna Boy has come at a time when it's really the ball is already rolling. People have really, really
same thing. You can say the same thing for Wizkid. You can say the same thing for Davido too.
They really expanded the field.
My thing is African Giant. There is no album numbers wise that can compare to that one out of the three of them. It's not even my favorite album. My favorite album is Outside by Burna Boy.
I like Outside too.
I like that one better than African Giant. But I'm just saying, right now as it is, Davido and Wizkid don't have any project that can compare to that on the global scale.
I actually struggle to like Davido and Wizkid's music that's on a global scale. I don't like Closer. I don't like that type of music because it's not authentic
it's
African
pop.
Music for me.
Wizkid does
that's why I like Burna Boy because Burna Boy stays consistently giving you African music, that fella vibe, you feel it. And I don't like the new music that Davido and Wizkid put. It's nice. It's trendy. I can listen to it in an Uber in New York, but it's not... It doesn't give you that kick of home. And that's what you like about
Burna. I hear
what
you're saying. I've heard like Wizkid before in Starbucks.
Yeah. Ojualegba, it gives you that vibe. You know, you hear Ojualegba,
exactly.
You're in the spirit. You know?
And I keep telling people
Jaya, what was that one?
If Africa was a country,
yeah,
in like 2015, yeah, Ojulegba would be the national anthem.
Oh, absolutely. For sure.
It gives you so much, even if you're not from the hood, like for real. Ojulegba, exactly, just puts you in the like, you know, you
it's
know
where you come song. From. Yeah. It's a very spiritual song. Very spiritual song. You know,
think it's not hard to understand.
Yeah.
I remember watching the MTV Awards in Africa, in South Africa. The MTV Africa Awards in South Africa, and he performed that song, and the South Africans were going crazy.
Yeah.
You know, he had a live band, and
no, it, well, it,
who are we to tell this kid or Bonado or David or what? You know, they want, they can produce what they want,
they
right?
Want, yeah, and I
these
can't
are our opinions, I guess. At the end of the day,
I don't have a top three for you. If
that's what I think, Davido's right now, honestly, for me. Even though Wizkid will always be Wizkid, but Davido has really put in the work, and Davido's this, really like legit right
this
now.
This most
like,
recent project is crazy to
last
me.
Yeah. Year, I would say hell no, but now I can't. I
yeah,
can't.
It's honestly, really crazy
really,
to see
really
his transformation.
He's really proven himself, and he's really just been up there, you know. And it's hard to maintain being up there, and that's what I hope that Bonner can do. Bonner has been in the game, but Bonner has not been on top.
2019, Bonner has different.
So whether
yeah.
he can sustain being on top, we'll see. You know, we'll be here.
Yeah, we'll be listening.
One thing I do remember is he said he would get nominated for a Grammy, and he did. So that's pretty cool.
Imagine if Bonner had won that Grammy. We're not here again.
I am the Grammy-winning African giant.
Yeah.
Second question: what's your favorite country in Africa to visit?
Or place? Visit?
How many countries have you been to in Africa?
I'm not sure in Africa, but around the world, about 32 countries.
Okay.
In the whole world, I think. Yeah, I just... but in Africa, how about we do cities?
Okay.
Favorite city in Africa?
Abuja.
I never understand
Abuja
this.
Is just everything for me.
Guys, after all this shit I talked about Nigeria.
Abuja is just like, if I was posted in Abuja, I'd pack up and leave in the next day. Abuja for
Why
me.
Why Abuja though? You know?
Because it's really a reflection of growth for me. It's a new city. It was constructed, and it shows a vision of constructing a modern day African city.
You know? I see.
So you see the vision, you see the roads, and Abuja is so authentic because even the roads, you know, they're named after great Nigerians, you know, like the infrastructure is so beautiful, and you can see when a society works hard where they can produce. So for me, Abuja really
work hard or corruption.
every country can be corrupt, but what you make out of that corruption is another story. And,
so
you know,
how come we never hear about Abuja? It's always
that's
Lagos.
True though. We always hear about the
because we only talk about the trendy places, and Lagos, I guess, is trendy for parties or whatever. But for me, really having a stable work life and not a lousy city, but a quality of life city is Abuja. You know.
Okay,
makes sense.
Very interesting. What about a second favorite city?
Second favorite city, I actually would not mind living in Addis Ababa.
Okay.
It's
really?
Very different.
Wow.
It's very different from us, but
older vibes.
Yeah. I like that traditional part of it. Okay. You know, like she's I feel like school. It's one of those countries where like it's authentically local. It's like Sudan, for example. Like authentically local. You see a lot of like the local different perspective of really like what an African country is. You know, everything is produced. Like I saw the toothpaste and stuff. Like they have it, some of it produced from Addis Ababa. It's so unusual
they're
for
self,
other African
you know,
countries.
They're self.
Yeah, they yeah. self. They consume self, what they consume, produce, yeah, what and they that's very.
That,
different.
Always been about I that though. Even that. Industries, they you know, industries are national.
Yeah, because you know, my dad gave me a leather jacket that he bought when I was probably around the time I was born.
Yep.
And it's still intact.
Yep.
Fun true story, my cousin, I won't say who, but he because he listens to this, but he bought a leather hat for the equivalent of maybe $10.
Wow.
In, yeah.
In Addis.
Wow. Belt I use this from
that's
Addis.
Probably pure yeah. leather, bro.
No, for sure.
For real.
And he sold it to a white man for $300.
Look at that.
Wow.
He needs to go back and buy more.
Look, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
You see?
No, yeah. But definitely.
The Lapa would have made
authentic.
A business out of it by now.
Out of the trunk of his car.
Yeah, Addis is authentic.
Addis?
Favorite food outside. You know, Gambia is the best food. We know that. But
relax.
Favorite food outside of, you know, Gambia food.
That's a hard question.
Favorite dish. Okay. Yeah. Not the absolute favorite, but one that, you know, stands
notable
out.
Ones.
Notable.
Coconut casada leaf.
Sierra Leone?
Well, it's not only cooked in Sierra Leone. They cook in cassava Nigeria
leaf.
As
coconut
well.
Coconut cassava leaf.
Yeah. Hmm. You know, people just eat cassava leaf with palm oil, but I like the one cooked with coconut
I've never
oil.
Had the coconut.
You have when we're in Sierra Leone. You used to eat it all the
Did
time.
Did they put coconut in there?
You just didn't know. Yeah. It's, it looks whiter than the regular.
That was heavenly. That cassava leaf slab. Shout out to all those who make the cassava leaves.
From Liberia, Sierra Leone. Liberia,
Sierra Leone, Guinea. Yeah.
Mana River people.
Yeah. Slabs.
I'm not a fan of coconut.
No. Look at me. I was complaining saying there's coconut in there. Ivan, you even know there's coconut in this farm.
It's the coconut oil.
They use coconut oil in there, bro. Right, this thing? Delicious. Yeah, coconut cassava leaf.
How about in East Africa?
I already told you that East Africa, maybe Ethiopian food is the most authentic. I love that. You know, the fish that they have from Uganda. I think that the fresh tilapia from the Nile is great. But one of the things I don't struggle to appreciate in East Africa was I feel like there was so much blend of other cultures that even translated in the food. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you serving me tilapia with French fries? I want the traditional thing that comes with the tilapia fish. Mm-hmm. French fries is foreign. But
couldn't you say that's to counter try and get the tourist market?
Then they will bring you salad. This is the point. And even when I was in Kenya as well, like...
What parts of Kenya did you go to?
Nairobi.
Did you go to Mombasa at all?
Oh, no. I would have loved to.
The coastal food is very good there.
Yeah, it's just that I just want the authentic. And I struggle with that in Gambia, too.
Yeah.
They always give you Lebanese food. Like
for what?
You know, in the restaurants. Uh-huh. Like, they give you chicken and chips. Or, like, you know, they give you, like,
a
shawarma.
Because the authentic food is being cooked at home.
Yeah, but it's I want it to be in restaurants, too.
Well, yeah, that's true. But back home, yeah, I think a lot of restaurants, they try and...
Again, another thing to appreciate about Nigeria. Yeah. You go to even the hotels, they're going to have a menu that's going to give you real...
Man, actually, I don't like this. You give Nigeria too much credit for.
So, you know, it is what it is. But definitely.
Okay.
Coconut cassava leaf.
Coconut cassava leaf.
Sierra Leone, Liberia.
Sierra Leone, but, you know, I would say Sierra Leone would be the primary...
It's the primary. And then Liberia too.
Yeah.
I had some Liberian chicken wings in the past and I almost burned my mouth.
See?
It was so spicy.
Chicken wings.
See? Liberian chicken wings.
This is the problem I have with Africa. They just say Liberian chicken.
They eat a lot of chicken. They just put their own spin on it and they put too much
pepper. So you just said chicken made in Liberian chicken. Is that what
it's like when you say jerk chicken, you think Jamaica and the Caribbean.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe Liberian.
I don't think African chicken wings, you can claim it as African
food.
Yeah, we eat chicken.
So you had Liberian chicken, my man.
They ain't got no Wingstop in Liberia.
That's true.
Yeah. No, but I get your point. Yeah. And you see how it makes us think about the lack of authenticity in the food we have.
We need to do that.
It's like a blend.
So guys, if anybody is into the food business or restaurant business, hey, create one back home and just make it absolutely authentic.
But they're there. Just the people there don't like to go there.
Yeah, that's true.
You get because in Kampala, right? It's to eat local food is kind of seen as
you can just eat it on time.
You take her to eat local food.
Exactly. They'd be like, what's all this? They want you to take them to Chinese restaurant.
What about for the tourists, though? If you're a tourist, right, I come in, I want to have, like what I started saying, authentic food, right? And let's say I don't know a Ugandan family, right?
Do you know what? I think because of also food standards, a lot of tourists are scared to try some foods.
If a restaurant is rated, highly rated,
I have an Oyibo friend I took to Bantaba, right? He wouldn't eat the chicken because it had bones in it.
What?
You get what I mean?
I hate chicken without bones. I always have this.
Exactly. So it's
chicken breast, fam.
No.
That's the way to go.
That's too much.
Tasteless.
Too much, yeah.
Tasteless.
The seasoning doesn't hit the right.
It doesn't.
Way. It's still, you can season it.
Yeah, but I guess, it really... You have that desire for authentic local cuisine.
Yeah, and me, when I go back home, there's on the way to my grandma's house, there's a roadside market that I have to stop by. Mm. They cook roadside chicken. Mm. They season it with basically just salt, and that's the best chicken I've had in the world ever.
Look at that.
You see what I'm saying? But how do you tell
how do you make
tourist?
That a restaurant? Or how do you get a tourist to eat that?
How do you get a tourist to do that?
Then they don't want to explore the local food. That's what it sounds like to me.
But I feel like they don't have the opportunity to. Because some of them, when they come, they rely on people to guide
them. Guides, local guides.
Them. And even the restaurants that they're staying in, they don't even have local menus, some of them. Yeah. Like, what type of restaurant?
Oh, they'll make it very Western.
The hotels,
yeah.
It doesn't hit the same.
So that's a problem.
Okay. Cool. Well, Evan, we have our pioneer of the day to close things up here.
Today is Haile Selassie, right?
Yes, in alignment with
African Liberation Day. My fault. We're recording this today is the 25th, so African Liberation Day.
So Haile Selassie,
the great emperor from Ethiopia, actually. Funny that you mentioned Addis earlier, but I don't know. There's so much we can say about
he was assassinated. Sorry, he was okay.
But I was gonna say there's a lot we can say about him, because his influence stretches past even our continent.
Absolutely,
you see his influence in Jamaica with the Rastafarian movement, where you know they believe he was,
because his full name was Rastafari.
Yeah, yeah. It's like his middle name,
Rastafari,
right?
Makonnen.
Yeah,
that's his full name.
Yeah. So his influence is just so crazy, because I mean, realistically, even Ethiopia was never colonized.
It was one.
They were occupied for some time.
But during World War II as well, they did.
He had to run. Italians did occupy.
Mussolini, you know.
Yeah, but that was very short-lived, I feel like.
But one of the things that, for me, like, makes him stand out so much is that he is, like, the godfather of the Organization of African Unity, mm-hmm. which is now the African
AU.
Union.
AU now.
Which is why it is based in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia.
Mm.
This is all, like, his idea of really having a united African front.
United Nations
and
of
this
Africa.
Is something that he took out of the continent as well. Like, Ethiopia is one of the first countries to contribute to United Nations peacekeeping, and that was in 1960 in Congo.
Mm.
So, you know, leveraging the international platform, even at the League of Nations, which is now the United Nations, at that time, really bringing in the story of, you know, injustice being done towards an African country or towards the continent of Africa, bringing it to the international platform where you can shame the people who are doing that. It's one thing, the human rights, everyone talks about it, but when you have an African leader in that time, at the beginning of this UN, you know, come in there and say about the human rights injustice that Italians were doing to Ethiopians.
Yeah.
Like, that is exposing the contradictions in what human rights is. And to have an African leader really put us on the map.
To be bold enough to step out there.
Created a platform where he brought African leaders and said, you know what, let's create
true
an organization where we all come together in unity and work towards uniting and developing our continent together. It's like... It's dope, and I think that, you know, he deserves all the accolades for that.
Yeah, small in stature but mighty in just everything he does, or did rather. So, I mean, E, what other things you have to add?
I mean, I just agree with her. I like this, doing these unsungs again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Haile Selassie. You know, a lot of people, especially if you're like say from Caribbean, they always think about it in Rastafari. You know, they almost idolize him. It's always good to know too, why is this person idolized beyond their name?
Yeah.
And what their impact was. Mm-hmm. So he was definitely one of them. I feel like it's like, you know, you have we always like strong, you know, African leaders that, you know, resisted, you know, powers from the West, powers of colonialism, you know. We have very few of them.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't, you know, simply yield. And, you know, your dad talked about how, let's say, Mobutu
mm-hmm.
was a puppet, you know, until he didn't become one. So, but we have very few class of leaders that, you know, they resisted for their people. So, you know, it's great to highlight them and know about them. I don't think it takes that much to spend 30 minutes of your day and just...
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's all about researching and history. Yeah.
So we're just making these names so that they can, you know, ring something in your head, you know, to say, go look it up, you know, and then you'll be like, wow, this is dope.
Yeah.
So, you know, glad we got to highlight it.
Yeah. Favorite place favorite place outside of Africa to go?
Hi, you guys have these really hard questions. Favorite place outside of Africa?
Mm.
I like India.
Really?
Yeah, I like India.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
Traditional, cultural, and very authentic cultural perspective. I like societies that have gone through colonialism and still held on to their cultural heritage. India is one of those for me. So I like India. Yeah.
Never.
She went to the Taj, Jaipur, and the Pink City. So
India's pretty dope. Yeah.
Okay.
They call it Incredible India.
Incredible India.
Cricket players in India make crazy money. That's bro. Fun fact.
Oh, yeah. IPL? I still watch it.
You still watch it? Yeah. I stopped watching that after DSTV.
Sheesh. Yeah, fam. But this was great, bro.
All right. Well, it's about that time. We need to wrap it up. But what a blessing to have you on the episode to just shine a light on an area that I don't think, at least I wasn't well versed in, and a few of our listeners will probably benefit a great deal from listening to. But thank you for taking the time out of your day to just talk to us today. E, what else do you have to say?
You said it all, you know. Merci beaucoup. Thank you.
Oui.
Oui, oui.
How you say thank you in Wolof?
Jere Jeff.
No, thank you guys for having me.
Do you have anything that you just want to say to the people?
Any last thoughts? Comments?
To our tribes people?
Never too late to learn. Just keep researching.
What would you say to someone who wants to maybe take up a career in international relations?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
You know, start somewhere. Even if it's just, you know, an internship or just a short-term job contract, just start somewhere. But I feel like we all have an obligation to, no matter what profession you have an obligation to somehow contribute to the service of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Find a purpose too.
Find your way back, like Beyonce said.
Yes, sir.
But
all right.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Well, thank you again. We're wrapping this up. Thank you all for listening to episode 5.
Keep listening. Catch up.
Perfect. Yeah, more fire, more tunes coming for you. Episode 6.
Yes, sir.
Stay safe.
Deuces.